Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is the award-winning writer, wildlife photographer, and magazine editor, Tim Gallagher. Gallagher is currently editor-in-chief of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology's Living Bird magazine. Since the age of 8, when he received his first field guide, he has been hooked on birds. He is the author of several books about his great passion, The Grail Bird, Hot on the Trail of the Ivory-billed Woodpecker, Falcon Fever, A Falconer in the 21st Century, and his most recent is Imperial Dreams, Tracking the Imperial Woodpecker Through the Wild Sierra Madre, published this month by Atria Books. And welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tish. Great to be here.
Yeah. Before we talk about this fascinating book, I want to talk to you a little bit about your obsession with birds. To tell us what it is that captured you from the age of 8.
Well, you know, it began a very long time ago, even before I was 8. I remember as probably a 3 or 4 year old, and when I was living in England, being in my grandmother's backyard and trying to talk to birds and, you know, get close to birds. And so it goes back a long time. And I got a parakeet for a pet when I was 6. And, you know, I started raising pigeons. So there was always some kind of birds in my life. But it was actually the bird watching where I officially got a field guide was about the age of 8. So I don't know what it's like not to be interested in birds.
So there was nobody in your family who turned you on to them and said, here, Tim, let me...
No. I mean, just my grandmother, I guess, you know. She liked the birds. She liked to feed the birds.
That's just amazing to me. I always think somebody who's obsessed with birds must always be looking up.
Yes.
You know?
It can be dangerous at times, too, believe me.
Well, let's talk about the latest book, Imperial Dreams. It's about the Imperial Woodpecker. Tell us a little bit about the history of it and why you became obsessed with this as well.
Well, you know, you've probably heard of the ivory-billed woodpecker, of course, from the American South, which is this huge woodpecker, really the second biggest one in the world. And the biggest one is its closest cousin, the imperial woodpecker of Mexico, which is a lot bigger. It's actually like a third bigger. It's 2 feet in length.
That's amazing.
It, like the ivory-billed, it's a bird that people have thought is extinct. And I just wanted to find out more about it. It's a bird that was never studied much. In fact, no one's ever recorded its vocalizations. Mm-hmm. No still photographs have ever been taken. The only photographic documentation is one short piece of film footage taken in 1956.
Yeah.
And that's it. So this is a bird we really don't know a lot about. That was the last documented sighting, was that one in 1956. They've pretty much vanished from all over their range for a variety of reasons, habitat destruction and actually killing the birds.
Oh, yeah.
And I just became determined to find out more about the birds. If nothing else, if I couldn't locate one, I wanted to go out in those places and talk to some of those people who remembered it. You know, if the bird isn't extinct, I reasoned that, well, these people are last living links with it. And I want to ask them questions, you know, while they're still alive.
Yeah.
Obviously.
You know, I would think if there were no living people who remembered it and no piece of film, it would be like in myth. It
right.
would be like mythological creatures like dinosaurs.
I know. It's almost like that anyway. Yeah.
Wow. So where was this found in abundance during its heyday?
Well, the only place it ever existed was that we know of is in the Sierra Madre Occidental in Mexico, which that mountain range begins about 50 to 75 miles south of the U.S. border below New Mexico and Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about 150 miles wide and goes down almost 900 miles. And a few of them were found in the Transvolcanic Range, too, right in Jalisco. But that's it. And that's not a huge area. And
no.
They were only in the high country. They're a bird with a very specific niche, these huge old-growth pine forests.
Uh-huh.
And much of that habitat's been logged. And this was a big, showy bird that made a lot of noise. You know, people I've spoken to said it was like a machine gun attacking
yeah,
these trees.
Yeah, you mentioned that in
and
the
some
book.
Some of them would, like, they'd work on the same tree for 3 weeks until it toppled over, you know.
God, so it's unbelievable. It does sound like something out of mythology, the
mm-hmm.
way it's described.
And speaking of mythology, we actually went up this canyon in the foothills and found a petroglyph of one of these birds, and it's really the only known depiction of this bird. And you can even tell it's a portrait of a female imperial because it's got a really far curved forward crest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have a picture of that in your
yeah.
book.
Yeah. Yeah. So I found that interesting.
Yeah, and a lot of people think of Woody Woodpecker when they think right. about woodpeckers. So tell us why this bird began to disappear. Logging, people shooting it, and you even mention in the book how Native Americans thought of the feathers as medicinal. And
yeah, some of the indigenous people there thought the feathers had magical powers, or you could hold them up to your head and get rid of a headache and things like that. And yeah, they were considered a delicacy by the Tarahumara, who apparently, from reports I've read from the 19th century, would sometimes even cut the tree down to get the young.
Oh, that's unbelievable.
And then we had museum collectors who went there and got some, but they really were never studied very much.
Yeah.
It's really incredible how little we know about them.
So they actually really did start disappearing in the 50s, right? There were a few sightings. You talked to people. Tell us about...
I always thought, and I think most people thought, that they were just collateral damage when all the logging took place. They lived in the mesa forests. It's up in the high country, but a lot of them are real flat, and the trees are widely spaced, in 8,000-9,000 feet. And actually, that was really easy lumber to exploit. It was easy for them to go up there, and labor was cheap. So they cut a lot of that, and a lot of it's been replaced by second growth, which is a lot smaller trees,
yeah.
really packed close together, not optimal habitat for them. And it used to be everyone thought this was collateral damage from that, and also the fact that whenever the logging areas opened up, other people would come in, and subsistence hunters probably were able to kill them easily. But I actually found evidence from my interviews that they were actively persecuted. I heard
people didn't like the noise and the.
Well, no, lumber interests. That they actually would tell the people, these birds are destroying valuable timber, and we got to do something about it. And there was one person I interviewed who said in the early 1950s, a guy was giving them poison to put on the foraging trees. And these birds were known to come back to the same tree like three or four weeks at a
yeah.
time until all the grubs were gone. So that would have been real effective. And not only that, it would have been like a population sink, because that group of woodpeckers might die and other ones might come in and feed on the same tree. So that could have been very devastating. And also they were being shot. I heard several reports of people seeing more than one at a time, people with dead ones. And there was one person who told me in the mid-1950s he rode past a sawmill in the Sierra Madre in the state of Chihuahua and saw six of them piled up in front of a sawmill.
Oh, you mentioned that in the book.
Yeah.
You know what I don't understand about this? Why wasn't anybody studying these magnificent, majestic, huge birds to try to save them?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I did find one interesting story where I interviewed a man who he used to go up in the high country with his father when he was 4 or 5 years old. He had cattle up there and everything. And he'd actually tie this kid to the saddle of the horse, because sometimes he'd lose him up there, but he knew the horse and knew how to get back to the cabin.
And, that was a funny story.
But he told me this fascinating story of an American who came down there and was really wanted badly to see some of these birds. And this was in 1948, and he was very concerned about them going extinct. The man said, well, yeah, I know where there's some up by Pito Real Pass, which this is in the high country above Chuichupa, which is interesting because the bird is called, in Spanish, it's the Pito Real. So he took this guy up there and had his kid with him. And they actually found a dead one at the base of the tree that someone had shot. And then he knew where the nest was right above the bird, so they decided to hoist the kid up the tree to see what was in the nest. and his father actually put a couple of lariats together, and he tied a log to it and threw it over a limb, and then made a little sling for the kid and tied the other end to a saddle horn, backed up the horse, and he just hoisted the kid 80 feet in the air or something. And then he even warned him, you fall out of there, kid, you're dead. So he's very much like Huck Finn's dad, so I picture him.
So the kid either ended up afraid of heights or
right,
thinking
right.
he could fly.
He actually pulled two young out of the nest that were already dead and brought them down to the bottom of the nest. And the American, he just burst out crying, and he just said, "I'm just like me to be too late. I'm not going to be able to do anything to save these birds. They're going to go extinct," which was a fascinating story, made all the more fascinating because I happen to, I go to museums a lot of times if they have imperials, and I'll look at specimens. And I saw a specimen at the San Diego Natural History Museum that was put into the collection in 1949, which is very late for an imperial. Most of them are in the 1890s and early 20th century. It was from that very area. It's from the high country above Chewichupa, and he spelt it phonetically, you know.
How funny. And, well, what do their feathers actually look like? You've seen live specimens. I mean, not alive, but specimens. Dead specimens. What do their feathers look like? Is the integrity being saved from all those years and years?
Well, they look pretty good, the specimens. They they still have that deep black and even a bluish sheen to them in certain light, and the red on the crest of the males is stunning, and the brilliant white.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, some of them are old and a little ruffling. It's the bills that kind of change color. They're not that bright white ivory color. They're almost like old piano keys, the way they'll get that brownish yellow.
Did you find in any of your research anybody who had painted these birds and tried to depict them from, you know, the 19th century or the early 20th
century?
Well,
I did, and one of the earliest was the bird artist and ornithologist John Gould, and he's the one who described this bird to science, you know, in the 1700s. And he wrote a letter to his friend and drew a sketch of this bird on the back of it. And he had this wonderful sketch of a female again with that crest going
forward.
And he was just, you know, amazed at this bird. And I was actually able to get a photograph taken of that letter at the Scottish Museum in Edinburgh.
Yeah, and you have a picture of it in your book.
That's right.
Yeah.
I tracked down a lot of interesting leads like that.
Yeah.
And then there are also beautiful color illustrations from the 19th century. And also my friend John Schmidt made one of the best ones I've ever seen.
Yeah. Oh, this is such a sad story, though. The imperial woodpecker, like you were saying, is a close relative of the ivory bill. Tell us just a little bit about your adventure with the ivory bill, because I know you had a major adventure with your friend Bobby Ray Harrison.
That was an interesting story, because, again, it was my obsession with birds. I thought, well, you know, I was very interested in the story of the ivory bill woodpecker, because people first started thinking it was extinct about 1910, 1915, but then there'd be sightings or people would prove it again, like Cornell professor Arthur Allen. He and his wife found a nest in 1924, and it was like a big deal on the newspapers around the country.
Uh-huh.
Oh, it's not extinct, the bird's been rediscovered. And some people actually read about it in the newspaper, some locals there, and they went out and shot him.
Oh, that story is so frighteningly maddening.
So then about 10 years later, another guy in Louisiana, Mason Spencer, backwoods lawyer, he said he knew where there were some, and the head of the Game and Fish Commission in Baton Rouge, he didn't believe him, and he actually gave him a collecting permit and told him to prove it. Guy went out and shot one, brought it back and threw it over his desk. And so, you know, so this is the way it was. And then after that, you know, when they finally logged this was called the Singer Tract, this 80,000 acre patch of virgin
Louisiana, right?
Swamp timber. Yeah, Louisiana. They logged that during World War II. After that, people pretty much said, yeah, they're extinct. And everyone who sighted one after that, they said, well, it's not true.
Yeah, and then they had no proof.
Right, that's right. And so I interviewed a lot of people. I interviewed people who remembered it from the Singer Tract, including James Tanner's widow, who was the guy from Cornell who studied them in the 1930s intensively there, and you know, several other people. But I started finding people who had much more recent sightings, usually hunters and people like that, and sometimes they didn't know what they were, but they had good descriptions of these birds and kind of no reason to lie. They didn't seem like the kind of people that would be lying. And I started following up on those, which was quite an interesting process in itself.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tim Gallagher. We're talking about his current book, Imperial Dreams, Tracking the Imperial Woodpecker Through the Wild Sierra Madre. Did you want to talk a little bit more about the ivory bill?
I'll talk a little bit more about the ivory bill. I started following up on a lot of those sightings, and a lot of times they were several years old and sometimes decades old, but they were very interesting, and if the places hadn't been logged, I'd check them closely. And then I heard about this kayaker, Gene Sparling, who had an interesting sighting in Arkansas just 6 days earlier. And that was like the newest, the most recent thing imaginable to me. Like someone actually saw one that short a time ago. So my friend Bobby Harrison and I just converged. And we, I flew down to Memphis and he picked me up on the way. And we were going to spend a week floating down Bayou de Vieux, where the guy had seen the bird. And just on the second day, in the middle of the day, we were paddling through there, and we just saw this bird coming up the swamp. And we knew it was a bird we'd never seen before, and it was swinging up to land on a Tupelo 70 feet away.
Yeah.
And it was just, it had all the field marshals going, whoa. And we just yelled, Ivoryville. It scared the hell out of the bird, of course. It went flying off. And we got as close to the side of the bayou as we could. And we just jumped out in like waist deep water and then pulling ourselves over logs and ripping our clothes. And, you know, we're almost in cardiac arrest. And then Bobby said, I saw an Ivoryville. And it just was crying.
Oh, that
big,
is
big bearded
so,
guy.
That is the sweetest story. But things changed for you after that. I mean, you
did.
Guys got famous.
Well, yeah. We spent a year, actually, before we told anyone, like really searching down there. We had more sightings. Took a really poor quality video of it, and that was the best we got. And it was just a single bird, perhaps one dispersing up there from somewhere else. Like, we never found like a nest location or anything like that. And we wrote an article for the journal Science, and it, you know, it became, as things like this do, it became very controversial. And so it's very polarized, the birding as well as the scientific community.
Yeah. No, I remember that. Before I even met you, I had heard about this.
So it's very, very interesting the way that's all turned out.
You know, the funny thing is that it was so hard for you to see this Ivoryville. I can't believe you went on and proceeded to try to find the Imperial. I mean, you even say in your book that people said it was like Tim Gallagher's looking for UFOs. You know, I mean, why did you
right.
do this?
Well, it was really something I always intended to do. It wasn't like, well, I did the Ivoryville and now I got to move to the Imperial. When I first began, I was doing both. I was interviewing people about the Imperial, too.
I see. Uh-huh.
Mostly Americans who'd been down there, sometimes in the 40s, like Arthur Allen's son had seen one in 1946, and people like that doing extensive interviews. But actually finding that Ivoryville derailed all that, because otherwise there'd have been a chapter or two in the Grail Bird about the Imperial.
Yeah.
It's funny looking back now. I remember when I first started looking in the swamp in the South that, you know, that kind of scared me. I'd seen, you know, Deliverance and Easy Rider, you know, when I was growing
so
up.
So had we
so
all.
Kind of visceral fear of the southern swamps.
Backwoods and, you know, were going to come
right,
and
exactly.
eat you.
But, you know, now after that, going to Mexico with all the drug wars and all that, it's just like there's no comparison. Anything in the swamp is just a walk in the park compared to some of these places.
This search for the Imperial actually became an adventure story of you just trying to survive in many ways. Right? I mean,
it did.
The book was scary, Tim. I can't believe. Tell us a few of those stories. I mean, you almost got killed. You almost died.
Well, and every trip we took, I went there five different expeditions in the space of about a year and a half. And every time I went, it seemed 100 times worse. And there were weird things happening, like we spent the night behind this rancher's home. In fact, it was Mitt Romney's cousin, Meredith Romney, who was of the Romneys who stayed in Mexico after the Mexican Revolution. So he's a big rancher down there, and he let us sleep behind his house. The guy I was with
behind
was
his
friends
house.
With.
Yeah, yeah. That's so typical of the Romneys, right? I'm only kidding.
Well, he's a good guy though. But, you know, a couple of weeks later, he was kidnapped at gunpoint and, you know, put in a bag over his head and carried up into the mountains and held in a cave for a couple, you know. Well, they're arranging ransom, and it turned out that of 18 people these kidnappers kidnapped, you know, 14 of them were killed, some of them who'd already paid ransom.
I can't imagine what kept you there looking
right.
for what people say is, you know, UFOs.
Yeah, yeah. And then later we actually made arrangements. We were having people help us, like foresters and other people, Mexican foresters who knew the area well and knew a lot of the people. And we actually at one point had a meeting arranged where we met some drug growers. And it was really fascinating because we were showing him that film footage from 1956 on this laptop. And the forester was telling them all about how, you know, you should help these guys. They're doing something really great here. They're completely good motives, and they want to save Mexican wild, this and that.
Oh, yeah.
And They said, oh, yeah, they completely, sure, we'll help them, we'll introduce them to people, we'll get help them with some guides, and, you know. But the thing was, we had to go for about a five-hour drive across hostile territory, which they said, you know, this is going to be dangerous. That night, some the forester got an anonymous call that warned us against going there, that, you know, those, they're really mad, that what are they doing there, we want to know where they're staying, their whole itinerary.
Yeah,
so it was like, then people were saying, oh, you should not do this, and some of the Mexican biologists just dropped out. And
yeah,
it was like,
it was very disappointing for
us. It was like Marchan and Lamertink and I, who's also from Cornell. Well, he said to me, well, do you want to do this? And I said, yeah, I really do, because we'd gotten some really good evidence. We'd located the last survivor of that expedition in 1956, and he told us right where it was, and he gave us photographs. If you can go find this rock outcropping, this is right by where we took the movies, and
yeah,
you'll be there. And we showed it to these guys, and they go, oh, see, Los Pilares, you know, the pillars. That they knew right where it was. And I just thought, we have got to go.
Yeah.
And we had looked on Google Earth. We'd seen places where the timber wasn't cut. And, you know, we just picked, you know, these high mesas with cliffs on the side. Maybe it'll be like the Lost World. And, you know what I mean?
You guys are still little kids at heart.
Oh, I know. And I just finally said, yeah, I want to go. But then I was sick about it. And then all these other guys dropped out of it, except for the two youngest, who were just field assistants. There was Oscar, who was 21, and Manuel, who was 16.
Yeah.
And he was the guy who was driving the old truck for us.
Oh, God. Well, tell us, I mean, tell us if you found any evidence. I mean, did you almost lose your life and get disappointed because?
Well, that was in the state of Durango, and that was a very discouraging trip, because even driving out there, some people drove past us carrying AK-47s, and they went up by the front vehicle where the drug people were, and were threatening them. We didn't know that until finally we stopped when we got into his village, and he was just white and shaky.
Oh, wow.
And then the first thing he did was go in his cabin and get an Uzi, and he was putting bullets into it and put it under his car. And in Mexico now, your regular people can't have guns. It's highly illegal, even like a .22 or something.
Yeah.
And they'll throw you in jail and confiscate your car. So this is a big deal. This is like an escalation if they're doing that. And then he warned us, do not under any circumstances go across to the other side of this river, because the Zetas control that. Those paramilitaries that used to be in the Mexican military and left to be a big drug cartel.
Oh, gosh. But did you end up disappointed, though? I mean, you obviously didn't find it.
Yes, we were very disappointed on that trip. That's the one where, in one of the interviews, that guy, this old man, told me, Gregorio, you know, he told me that about them poisoning the birds,
mm-hmm.
and that he'd seen groups of 10 or 12 before that in the 1940s and early 50s, and when they did that, they really pretty much vanished.
Oh, and, see, and that, I found that discouraging.
That's when I realized
too, yeah,
this was not collateral damage. This was an extermination campaign.
Yeah, yeah.
And it fit in with other extermination campaigns that had been waged in Mexico against the wolf, which the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service provided the poison for that, the grizzly bear, and the Apaches. They were fighting Apaches into the 1930s in the Sierra Madre.
Everything that goes through the Sierra Madre becomes extinct, it feels like.
Oh,
you know,
I know.
That's what it felt like to me.
Well, you know, it's interesting, the story of Geronimo, because he was really from that area, and he always had his stronghold there. I visited the area where he hid out, and mm-hmm. I knew someone who owned a ranch near it. When he surrendered in 1886, a lot of his people who didn't want to go onto the reservation, they just left and they went back to the Sierra Madre.
Oh.
And they continued. They didn't come into the U.S. anymore, for the most part, raiding, but they did in Mexico. And they, really for a couple of centuries, the Apaches didn't let that one area of the mountains be settled, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And it wasn't really until the 1930s that people were able to get in there and log and do some, you know.
The destruction must be so, I mean, you're an environmentalist, you're an ecologist in many ways, and how do you feel about this? I mean,
oh, it makes me sick. I mean, the thing that makes me sick the most is the feeling of helplessness, the feeling that if I'd found an imperial woodpecker out there, if I'd found a nesting pair,
yeah,
I couldn't have done anything.
No,
the military's not going to go up there and protect some bird. They can't even protect their citizens who live up there.
Yeah, they can't even protect their own.
It's like the Wild West. I mean, on the good side, it's like the Wild West in that you feel like you're stepping back into the 19th century. Most of the people up there live in adobe huts with dirt floors or in cabins hewn from the surrounding forest, and they don't have plumbing, water, electricity, telephones. Cell phones don't even work there. The roads are so bad. They're not even really roads, and it can take you 5 hours to go 20 miles.
Oh, it's an amazing adventure.
And that's interesting. Everyone rides, they ride mules and horses, and which they shoe themselves.
Yeah.
So I love that. But at the same time, there are these drug guys with their big club cab pickups with dark-tinted windows and guns bristling everywhere.
Yeah. And obviously, some kind of a mentality that doesn't really care about keeping wildlife safe and keeping the environment, healthy. So tell us, do you still believe there are imperial woodpeckers? Do you think you could still find them?
I believe that there's a handful. I had enough interesting descriptions from people. For the most part, in most areas you go, the only people that remember it are in their 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
I mean, I had an interview with a guy who was 99 years old, literally on his deathbed.
Uh-huh.
Had very interesting memories of it. But I did have a number. There was even one guy who just 3 years earlier, he said he and his son had been, riding across this mesa not that far from where they lived and seen one of these birds. And he picked it out. I mean, I just had a bunch of pictures of birds, and I'd have people go through it. And he said, I remember, 3 years ago, and we didn't know what it was. His son, is that some kind? I mean, that's how far divorced people are from the imperial woodpecker now.
They
don't even, young people don't even remember it.
Yeah.
And this guy's probably about 50, and his son was in his 20s. And
so you still believe?
So this guy shot it and wounded it and wrapped it up in a blanket, and then they sat down and ate lunch, and then his son went over to check on it and lifted up the blanket, and it flew away. It was just wounded,
Wow.
And that seemed believable. And then there was another guy who was working at an archaeological site, which was up in the mountains in the pine country where the birds are supposed to be, but the archaeological site was in a canyon. It was like these sort of pueblos in the cliffside. There was a little building there that he worked in. And he said one day, 3 or 4 years earlier, in fact, I think it was in 2008, he said, the spring, he heard this weird bird, this weird call he'd never heard, and he didn't even know if it was a bird or if it was a person doing it, which they have this weird, it's like a toy trumpet.
Yeah, you described it.
He went running out, not knowing if it was even a bird, and then it flew off, and it was this big, elongated woodpecker. And later he described it to his father, and he said, oh, see, that's Pete Thoreau,
Oh, my God. So I'm going to believe along with you that they're still there.
That's right. But this guy had worked there for 20 years, and that was the only time he'd seen one.
Wow. Well, this is an amazing story. Tim Gallagher, do you have any contact information people can get in touch with you, website or anything?
I have a blog that people can contact me through. It's imperial-dreams.blogspot.com.
Great. Well, Tim Gallagher, thank you so much for joining us. Again, the book is called Imperial Dreams, Tracking the Imperial Woodpecker Through the Wild Sierra Madre. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Tish. It was my pleasure.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.